Hi, and welcome to episode 82 of the VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by my good friends Jason Wingrove. How are you, Jace?
I'm well, Mike. How are you?
And David Stropinis.
Hi, how are you doing?
I should say that we expect to hear a more relaxed David Stropinis this week, a more laid-back, feet up, Mai Tai, Hawaiian shirt David Stropinis.
A well-rested David Stropinis, yes.
Excellent.
We always hear a nicely well-rested Jason Wingrove, even when he's not, but that's because Jason hasn't just come off one of the biggest films that will be coming out at Christmas, I believe, David, is that right?
A week before Christmas, yeah.
Really, sadly, you know, I think it's worth actually noting before we get into this week's show, which will be Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, a obviously major mega blockbuster film that you've just finished on that film. And of course, you were associated with a lot of things, but one of them was principal photography. So just think about this for a second right now. It's now the middle of the year. Imagine that you are on the team that was with David. I'm not asking you to comment on this, David, but for everybody else, imagine that you're on a team and you go, okay, a film with greater expectations than the next coming of Christ. And you've got, you know, you look at your watch and you go, okay, it's almost the end of June, give or take beginning of July, and people are walking into cinemas with their $14 at Christmas, and I have to deliver everything by then. And that sense of impending doom that all of us have faced when you've come off principal photography, you know, just spare a thought for the visual effects artists around the world that are going to spend the next 6 months sweating bullets to, as you would on any film, to get to the deadline. But one of them isn't you, David. You're onto new things.
I am. I'm actually onto nothing right now, which is
an excellent new thing.
Yeah, it's an amazingly pleasant experience to be doing absolutely nothing at all.
Without commenting on the film, how long were you on the film? Without commenting.
2 years, 10 months, 8 days, I believe, was the final count. Almost three. If I'd gone through August, it would have been 3 years.
So. And we will, of course, look forward to discussing that film when it's appropriate. But we're not here for gossip or anything. So let's turn our attention to Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen, and probably the biggest blockbuster to come out so far this summer. It'll be interesting to see how it fares up against other things at the end of the summer. But right now, it is definitely the film of the month, if not the season. And the thing I think most extraordinary about this film, before we get into the visual effects of it, is just how incredibly split the critics are versus the box office. I've never seen, in the time that we've been doing this show, a film that is so split between the critics basically just hurling Rotten Tomatoes at it and audiences queuing up and actually maxing out IMAX's revenue for a film. I mean, I went to see this film both at a press screening and then I actually paid my money to see it at IMAX because some of the shots were done with IMAX cameras. And when I was waiting to get in, I'd already bought my ticket, of course. My wife was coming to join me, so I'm just standing out the front. There was just a queue of people being turned away. And this was on a, you know, the film opened here in Sydney, like on a Thursday, Friday. They were saying to people that there was not one seat available for any screening of this film at IMAX until the following week, on Monday or Tuesday of the following week. So that means that, you know, days and days, every session had already sold out in advance. And yet, if you were to read the reviews online, the impression you'd get is that this is the worst film since basically, you know... Since,
the word hasn't got out there, maybe, obviously. Maybe word of mouth hasn't got out yet. Well, I don't think even that will stop people. The session I went to was absolutely jam-packed with 16-year-old and 15-year-old boys, so it was...
Let's start with you, Jason. Let me ask you this question. If a film has critics to review it, at one level to tell an audience that's a potential audience member whether they should see the film or not, does this render in any way kind of... in a big picture sense, a critic irrelevant? If critics are saying, don't see this film for the love of God, it's horrible, and audiences are saying, I can't wait to see this film, I'm willing to queue up and buy tickets weeks in advance and see it. I mean, are the critics by definition wrong?
Well, I guess the critics are not probably of the same demographic of the people that are actually the ones flooding to see this film. I don't know what the average age of the ones that were going to see it at IMAX, probably slightly older, but I guess... you know, 15-year-old boys don't really look at reviews.
But, I mean, clearly. Is the job of the reviewer...
Or care, really. It doesn't really matter. You're just after a thrill, you're after a bit of fun, non-stop action, lots and lots of slow-mo, Megan Fox breasts, and...
Don't even get me started yet on the sexist nature of the film, but...
Well, explosions.
But the thing is, by definition, right, the critics are meant to be reviewing the film for a wide audience. I mean, we're not talking about specialists. We're doing, on this show, a discussion of the visual effects, and that's a specialist thing. But I'm talking about general, big, normal film reviewers in daily papers have been panning it. David, what does this say about the film? And have you seen something that's this sort of, diverse in opinion?
I can't recall off the top of my head anything where the critics were so vitriolic in their hatred of it, yet it succeeded so, you know, incredibly well with audiences. But, you know, this movie is McDonald's, right? It's fast food. It's people know what they're getting. It's not fine cuisine by any means, but you know what? People feel comfortable. They like it. And, you know, I'm sure food snobs, you know, look down their faces at McDonald's, but you have to admit, if you're on an airplane and somebody opens up a bag of McDonald's and you get that Big Mac smell hit your nose, you're you know, you start going, and you crave it. And I think that this movie is kind of the same thing.
But let me just interject there for 1 second. I understand your analogy, but the analogy falls over in the fact that you could argue fairly reasonably that the quality of the culinary skill of those making the McDonald's hamburger is fairly minimal. None of them are, you know, cordon bleu trained. The technical expertise required to produce a McDonald's hamburger is pretty small. You literally, I'm not saying anything against McDonald's food, but I mean, you know, it's not a particularly complicated job to put the fries in the deep fryer and pull them out when the thing goes beep. By way of contrast, this is a film that would not have been easy to make. This film required incredible depth of filmmaking skills at a technical level to pull off. And so,
oh, absolutely.
At one sense, you're sort of, I totally get your point of view that it's fast food, you know, it's like for the masses. But by the other sense, this is a really incredibly complicated piece of filmmaking requiring a level of technical sophistication that is quite daunting.
Right. I mean, it reminds me of, I remember when Team America World Police came out, which was, you know, Matt Parker, Trey Stone, or Matt Stone, Trey Parker, can never get that right. You know, they were kind of lambasting the whole Bruckheimer Bay film genre. That's how they set out to do it, and to do it with puppets. And, you know, I remember afterwards, they're like, these movies are hard to make. Like, I get really annoyed when people call Michael Bay a hack because he's not a hack. He may not be a Cameron, a Spielberg, a Fincher, but he's definitely not a hack because what he does actually does take some skill. You know, you can look at any frame of a Michael Bay film and instantly know it's a Michael Bay film. And that says something, you know, but to put together this spectacle that he did takes a hell of a lot of work by many, 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 many people. And it's an achievement to get it up on the screen. Now, what wound up on the screen? Is it Moon? Is it Hurt Locker? Is it No Country for Old Men? No. But I didn't go into it expecting, you know, the sequel to Glengarry Glen Ross. You know, I don't go to a Michael Bay film for pithy dialogue. You know, I go to, you know, blam, blam, boom, wow, boobs. That's why I go to a Michael Bay film. And,
I mean,
and
isn't it a bit like the opening ceremony of the Olympics in that you could argue quite reasonably that it's no Shakespeare? The opening ceremony of the Olympics is just like lots of big, flashy, shiny things. And there's not a lot of, you know, sort of subtext to a lot of people jumping around with
it's
flags.
It's the Olympics without the events. This is let's have 10 days of opening ceremony.
Yeah, well,
But it's very hard to put on the opening of the Olympics, right? It's like it's a major undertaking of enormous complexity. And yet,
except for the thing is when China put together the opening ceremonies, they got a talented director in Zhang Yimou, and it was called the best opening ceremonies ever.
Okay, but you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not... Like, there is, it's fair to say, issues with this at a filmmaking level when you're talking about subtext and character development and arcs and plots and stuff. And we'll obviously poke fun at some of them, as we tend to do. But at a very real level, I mean, if you were to just take away the actual film for a second and think of it in the abstract, trying to enlist the amount of resources that this film did, not only are we talking about IMAX cameras and that kind of stuff on a few shots, but... And not are we even talking about the visual effects for that matter, which are just daunting in themselves, but just convincing the US Army, Navy, and Air Force to lend you a whole lot of their kit. Not to mention the fact that this is the first film in decades that's actually shot in the Middle East. Now, yes, I have huge problems with the fact that they've placed the pyramids right beside the water, as if like the pyramids have an oceanfront view. And I understand enough geography to kind of go, wait a second, that's not Valley of the Kings. But that isn't the point. The point is they are actually shooting in the Middle East, and maybe that's changed a little with Obama's speech in Egypt and stuff. But all of this was shot way back before that. So there's logistical aspects to this that are just mind-bendingly big, and you know, it takes more than just the will to want to pull that off. I mean, not any director could walk in to a meeting and say, I think it's a really great idea to shoot in the Middle East. I think it's a really great idea to be setting off vast explosions. I think we should get the Army, Navy, and Air Force to lend us all their gear. I think we should have ILM do, you know, some of the greatest complex effect shots we've seen in years. Like, there's almost like a presence required to get to the level that you can even command that kind of stuff at a filmmaking level. Did you agree, David?
Oh, absolutely. But to get back to your original point where you were asking about critics and the audience being separate, I think the critics go into a movie looking for character, looking for plot, looking for, you know, emotional conflict. And I don't think that Michael Bay set out to make a movie that had plot or character or, you know, emotional conflict. He set out to make a big visual auditory orgy, and he did, and audiences wanted a big audiovisual orgy, and they got it, and they're going to see it over and over and over again. And they are. I mean, I was at the Arclight today, and it was, you know, packed with people going to see Transformers still on a Monday.
I mean, Jason, I've seen it twice.
Why? On purpose?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, well, obviously, because you're technically wanting to look at it on IMAX, I wonder how many people would actually want to go and see it twice.
I think we'd be naive to think this wasn't going to do gangbusters on DVD.
All right. Well, I mean, to Dave's McDonald's analogy, I just think this is like not just going to eat at McDonald's. This is somebody strapping you down to a McDonald's chair, walking up to the counter and ordering every single thing on the menu, and then hammering it with a blunt quarter pound hammer, force feeding you like someone who's trying to create fine pate.
Well, here's the thing, right? Let's just discuss the Michael Bayness of it then, right? I mean, if we agree for a second that there is both a lack of like complex subtlety, and we're going to get onto the visual effects, obviously, as we always do, but just to discuss this point, I think you just have a kind of a class of film that is a class of film that says we want the whiz bang, my seat vibrating from the subwoofer type stuff. And you know what? Like a film clip, right? I don't expect a lot of story in a film clip, but it's great to watch and I enjoy it. That this is like a film that says we're not trying to tell a detailed story. We're not trying to do a character piece. We're trying to do a different piece. And the different piece is this genre that is, you know, the action-y, blockbuster-y thing. And I think that's really, like, a really interesting point about this is actually connected to the Academy Awards, who this week announced that they were going to have 10 films in the running for Best Picture. And the general theory put forward was why they were doing this is that a bunch of popular films never get into the running for Best Picture. So you end up with the Academy Awards having a bunch of films that almost no one has seen, general Joe public speaking now, versus the films that rate at the box office. And they're hoping if they extend it out to 10, that while the, you know, summer blockbuster films will not win Best Picture, at least that the audience will care about the Academy Awards a bit more because they're in the contention. And do you think that's fair, David? I mean, you must have seen that news about the Academy Awards this week.
Yeah, I saw it. I thought it was stupid, but because I mean, literally, it just means that you can only have to get 11% of people to agree that this movie was the best movie of the year. You know, I thought the ideal thing would be to get you know, down to 3, because then you'd actually have to get a majority of people to vote for one movie almost, or even down to 2. But
I agree with you. I totally agree with you. But I'm just saying that the motivation that I think is behind the move is that the Academy is frightened by the fact that they have a bunch of films that nobody's seen, in the running for Best Picture, and a bunch of films everybody cares about because they pay just, their money.
It just means that you're going to have 10 movies that no one's ever heard of rather than 5 movies that no one's ever heard of. I think this is kind of a knee-jerk response to Dark Knight last year, but it's kind of it's you get the movies that only critics and quote-unquote film snobs care about. But if I want to go see, what are they going to do, introduce Best Kiss category again, steal that from the MTV Movie Awards, or Best Emotional Baggage Scene from a movie starring Katherine Heigl, she'll be a shoo-in every year. But
okay, well, I don't make too much about it, but I just think that there is this sense that there is a big divergence between the critics and the highbrow and what the public is paying their money to see.
I didn't go to see... I wasn't expecting to walk in and see, Driving Miss Daisy with robots or anything. I fully knew what I was in for. I just think... I think a little bit of light and shade would be good rather than just all full on. It's really hard to appreciate the light when there's no shade. It's hard to... The audience just really doesn't get a chance to draw breath, and when it does actually pause for breath sometimes, that's actually when some fun stuff happens, I think. Apart from those two freaking annoying car bots, I thought,
this movie was big, loud, stupid, aggressive, sexist, and racist. It was the perfect way to finish off 8 years of Bush Cheney. It was kind of a the penultimate expression of the past 8 years America's gone through, and it's a nice way of saying see ya, go. It's.
I had an aha moment when I was watching Armageddon back in '98, and I heard the commentary track on it. And the DOP was speaking about a shot they did where the car pulls up. It's like a BMW. They're at, I'm pretty sure it's Armageddon. If it's not Armageddon, it was Pearl Harbor, but I'm pretty sure it was Armageddon. And this is like a little scene in the early of the film, and there's some little strung out lights, and they start kissing on the hood of the car. It's a low shot from the side, backlit, sunset. And the DOP said, and Michael Bay said to me, BMW commercial. And I knew exactly what he was talking about because we'd done a lot of commercials together. And I went, well, yeah, it looks like a commercial. It no longer looks like a feature film. It looks like a commercial. And then I had the aha moment that he'd taken the sensibility of TVC with its perfect everythings and stuck it in a feature film and basically made feature films with a TVC aesthetic. And I'll point to the scene where Megan Fox is spray painting the side of the motorbike in this film.
Badly.
But apart from the fact... Sorry?
Spray painting it very badly.
Well, yeah, I mean, apart from the fact that it's much more of a gynecological exam of her from the audience's point of view than it is any kind of attempt to spray paint. And obviously it would be nice to actually be able to face the thing that you're spray painting to actually see what you're doing.
Exactly.
But that shot was an incredibly advertising-rich aesthetic. That was not a feature film aesthetic. But that's what he's brought to the film. And now I don't like that scene. I find that almost to the point of insulting, and I'm not even a woman. But
that's the same aesthetic applied to the entire film, though, Mike.
Okay, but my point is, though, that is this aesthetic of what I'm going to call a TVC aesthetic applied to feature filmmaking and mega budget at that. But anyway, I mean, maybe enough said.
Guys, it is a 2-hour-and-10-long movie about toys from Hasbro.
Exactly.
It is a commercial. The entire thing is an adaptation of a cartoon that was in itself a commercial.
Can I ask you guys, get into Transformers when you were kids? I mean, did you hit that thing?
Oh, God, yes.
See, I
really?
Didn't. I must be older than you, but I just missed it completely. I was like, if you're an alien and you can fly around in space, why would you turn yourself into a car? Why turn yourself into a truck when you
I did ask myself that question a little bit throughout the film. Why is he bothering to be a truck? And then you go, whatever.
Okay,
I wasn't into
But I know that there was for a generation, and maybe you're part of that, David, this was the cleverest idea in ever. When you're a kid, this was the cleverest idea anyone ever had ever, right? It was like...
Oh, yeah. It was awesome. I remember, my parents, the year the Transformers came out, my mom actually flew from Connecticut to Chicago to go buy a Soundwave. That's the in the original toy, it was the guy who turned it into the cassette recorder in the movie. It was a guy who was latched onto the satellite. She flew from Connecticut to Chicago to buy a Soundwave action figure from FAO Schwartz and then flew back. Because this is the days before FedEx overnight, the day before Christmas. Yeah.
This is a parent that loves you. Okay, well, let's switch gears now and talk about the visual effects, of which there's a lot to discuss.
There is a lot.
Yeah, there is a lot. And it's a sequel, so there is a natural sense of raising the bar and going for a higher level. Let's talk about the special effects before we get into the visual effects, because there was a lot of practical effects work done. And some of that work is, without a doubt, in my opinion, just magnificent. I have plot issues like most people do, but I'm going to talk about special effects and visual effects for a second. And the one I want to start with is the massive gasoline bomb that was shot near the end of the film. And doing some research for this, or as we had research done for us by our research team, they came up with the fact that that particular big bomb blast at the end took 7 months to set up. It was a 1,000-gallon gasoline bomb. And it would actually take longer to set that up and shoot than the entire film was in principal photography. And I've got to say that those explosions at the end, those visuals, I mean, I was sitting there and it took me out of the film because I was like, oh my God, I don't think that's digital, but if it's real, what's the carbon footprint on this film? I mean, I just was like stunned at the scope of some of that stuff. What about you, Jase?
Yeah, I think, as you say, I did get taken out of the film a little bit. I thought it was fantastic. It was a really, really amazing gag. I'm amazed it took 7 months to set it up, though. I mean, why?
Well, I presume because, you know, you don't let fly something like that without a lot of work in permits. And, I mean, I'm a huge amount of money, I mean, just pre-production, getting permission to do it, and as well as just sort of physically setting it up, I think would take 7 months.
Yeah, sure, I'm sure, absolutely. No, look... I did get taken out of the film a little bit, but maybe that's us as filmmakers. Maybe it's a little bit easier to get taken out of the film, going, "Wow, how did they pull that off?"
It must be hard if the brief you get, like if you're the guy that's organising that, if you're like John Fraser, and somebody comes to you and says, "I'd like a gasoline bomb go off." Oh yeah, sure, probably we can do a thing. Yeah, I'd actually like it to be bigger, so big that it's like better than anyone else has ever seen before. You know, the bar on a gasoline bomb explosion has got to be set pretty high. It's not like we haven't seen it before.
Yeah.
What about you, David?
I mean, it's really nice to see kind of a return to the old-fashioned way of actually doing something rather than doing it all digital. You know, Dark Knight kind of started it when they flipped the truck. Terminator did it when they blew up the whole gas station. You know, and here we have a massive explosion, and it's, you know, you can comp in all the explosions you want, but it doesn't hold the same weight as, you know, the big napalm run in Apocalypse Now or what have you, when I think viscerally you do sense, like, that was really there. Like, that was a real explosion that big, and I just got at least four of my dollars worth, you know, of whatever you paid to see the movie. And
that's for a visual reference, though. I must admit, that napalm run from Apocalypse Now would be like one of the few that I would place above this one as being just all-time amazing. I mean, that really was jaw-dropping in the extreme, especially when it was done.
Yeah, I think the three I can think of that could maybe top this is the napalm run in Apocalypse Now, blowing up Cyberdyne in Terminator 2, and maybe blowing up the hospital in Dark Knight. But
blowing up the hospital. That was a bit more complicated than just, you know, like a whole bunch of fuel going up.
I think Dark Knight had a more story filmic kind of twist to it. I mean, that was just like this lovely Heath Ledger moment as well. I'd probably put this one above the T2 one because I think this was pretty amazing. But they're all good references. But it's good company to be keeping, right? Like, these are all terrific
sequences.
Yeah, absolutely. The pyrotechnic show.
My favorite practical effect in the whole movie was actually the scene where he attacked Reading and destroyed the library. I thought that was just one of the best metaphors that movie had. You know, let's actually destroy knowledge. Okay. But...
Okay, so if we give the special effects guys their due and deservedly thus, They would have created an enormous amount of problems by the quality of their work for the special, the visual effects guys, for two reasons. One, because they did set the bar pretty high. But secondly, because there was a lot of smoke and dust and stuff flying around, and somebody had to get in there and do tracking on it. And I'm going to say right out of the gate, I think ILM's work on this is just immense, and Digital Domain's, but just unbelievable in terms of tracking and complexity. In fact, I'll give you some stats, and I haven't personally confirmed these, but these are from, I believe, are right, from the research. There were like 14 robots in Transformers, and I got to speak to Feng Zhu in Singapore recently. He was on some of the concept art for that, and he actually worked on several robots that were done that weren't used in Transformers 1 that ended up in Transformers 2, and there were 46 this time around. And the complexity of the robots themselves was about three or four times that of the previous Transformers. So obviously some of them were bigger, but in terms of just, you know, how hard they were to make and render, they had more moving parts, more texture maps, more complexity in terms of their very size. And so whether or not, you know, you go for the bigger is better thing, I mean, they were immensely complicated pieces of animation, and it wasn't just like a nice big procedural thing where, you know, everything would just sort itself out and like a water sim. This was pretty complicated stuff. David, did you feel like the bar had been significantly lifted by DD and ILM?
Yeah, one of the main designers for the Transformers, Ben Proctor, is a friend of mine, and he designed Bumblebee, for instance. And, you know, I think some of those robots have upwards of 10,000 parts that are on them. And the way ILM has these rigged up is, you know, you can grab any part and, you know, press a couple buttons and you can move it however you want. And then it's dynamically linked to a different object and then, you know, rotates around and then that's relinked dynamically to something else. So the rigs on these were incredibly impressive. But you did mention texture maps, and that was the one thing that bugged me to all high heaven about the CG in this movie. I remember when I saw the trailer, I was like, something is bugging me about Bumblebee. And then it hit me, which is when he is in car mode, he is right off the showroom floor, beautiful, you know, glassy surface, not a single scratch, dent, smear, dirt, nothing. But yet when he transforms into robot form, he's scuffed up, he's covered in grease and oil, and he's scratched and all that kind of stuff, and then he transforms back into a perfectly clean car.
Absolutely,
and I realized
that's the pack shot.
I'm sorry, what was that?
That's the GM pack shot. You can't have that dirty. You can't have the car dirty.
Exactly. So it's
otherwise, you know.
But
GM
isn't there
might,
wasn't there like
might,
a big
you know,
extension though to the concept of a Transformer in this film, in the fact that we were suddenly moving to they were holograms and people. Because the one for me that was different to that is the idea that the Transformers were transforming into, you know, semi-naked chicks with admittedly kind of fairly evil tongues. But was that always in the Transformer mythology that you could just become people that were indistinguishable from humans?
No. Well, first off, I want to go to whatever college that was, because that was the most amazing co-ed dorm in the history of the world. But, I mean, I was sitting there going, is every single girl going to be a Victoria's Secret model?
Now, that was explained because they stacked the dorm rooms by the computer hacks stacked the dorm rooms with the top, you know, 50 girls of the college.
Yeah, well,
that was
still
kind of
whatever.
A plot point. But I will say I had the same experience. It's like when I see shots of Vegas and they show people in black ties and it's all like, and I go, you know, my experience of Vegas is elderly couples in leisure suits
pants.
Sitting in front of you know, slot machines,
nickel slots,
with the cigarette hanging out,
walkers.
With the sort of ash hanging longer than it should.
Well, the girl with the killer tongue, which, wow, did that sound wrong? That brings up a point. Did anyone notice it was almost a series of homages to a whole bunch of action and sci-fi films of the past, like 20 years? You had that, which kind of reminded me of the T-1000 or the Terminatrix from Terminator 3. You had the little Jar Jar robot. You had the little probe thing, which was right out of the Matrix. You had
Matrix crossed with Aliens for the face hugging.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, the shot on the aircraft carrier, which I for a moment thought was a stock shot taken from Top Gun. there was so many shots in this movie, and it's, I'm not deriding it, but it seemed like a lot of, we're going to take this thing from this movie and do it bigger. And that girl just reminded me too much of the Terminatrix.
But anyway, to get back to your point, actually, because we also had that at the beginning when the motorbike chicks suddenly hologrammed on top of on the motorbikes in the Shanghai sequence.
So yeah, that was in the first movie as well. They had the holographic cop inside of the police car.
Oh, okay.
Decepticon.
So. Well, I was starting to go, hang on a second. I thought, because I also, you know, in the first, I mean, not being of Transformers, I was imagining there was some conservation of size. I mean, if you're going to bother inventing parts, why would you invent parts that look like giant hubcaps? You know, so I was assuming that it was the original hubcap from the original car, that, because, you know, I assumed the toy, you know, obviously conserved mass because it was a plastic thing that didn't exist in the real world. So in the first film, I was always like, how come the Transformers are so much bigger than the things they transformed out of? In this one, it seemed like they could just metamorphosize into anything they wanted, and it was an arbitrary decision to end up looking like a thing that was made of a truck. Because to a certain extent, I don't understand how you come from outer space and are made of things that look like a truck. In fact, I don't understand that at all.
Well, yeah. the thing is like they are look like generic robots, and then it's whatever they kind of touch, they take, you know, they're able to take on the form, so they can disguise themselves as that.
But when they're not disguising, they then still look like they're made out of bits of trucks.
If they just came straight from space and decided not to take on the form of anything else, they kind of look like a pile of parts, like they do as robots, just without any kind of automotive aspect to it. Just
like the Fallen did.
Yes,
it's
a lot like
possible
the Fallen.
We're over rationalizing it a little bit.
Yeah, the problem with the toys was always that you can make either a cool-looking robot or a cool-looking whatever it transformed into. It very rarely did it look cool in both ways.
Yeah.
So I think they were trying to strike a balance of being able to have cool-looking robots. Unfortunately, because they had such a distinctive style to their robot look, it was really hard to tell one from another. As frenetic as the action was in this, you know, I could never really tell, you know, who was who, and you could barely tell what was going on, but I think originally they're all supposed to look like the robot who's like Darth Sidious to Megatron's Darth Vader.
Okay so let's talk about the animation of these things, because we've discussed, you know, like, and I've got obviously taken us on a digression there discussing the logic of it, but in terms of the way they moved and the kind of the performance, I guess you'd describe it as, of the, I'd be interested in your opinions, David, as what you sort of thought they moved like and were animated as.
Oh, the animation itself was fantastic. That fight scene in the forest.
I was about to say that the Optimus Prime fight scene was pretty spectacularly good.
Just unbelievable. Just really, really fantastic. And the shot, I really remember the shot of Sideswipe, which is the Corvette car, slicing the guy in half. Like, I remember that shot very, very clearly. But unfortunately, the animation in my mind was a little bit ruined by some of the gaggy things that were done with, the robot humping her leg and, like that character and the very racist twin characters. Those guys just kind of bugged me. But the animation itself, especially when you got into the high frenetic action, was really, really fantastic. And, the one issue I had was that there seemed to be a lack of motion blur on a lot of the CG elements. But I don't know if that was a stylistic choice or if that was...
I agree with you on that. I especially on the pyramids, I was really curious about the motion blur. The only thing I could think of is that somebody maybe asked them to wind it back so they could make a bit more sense of what the heck was going on. But
that was my exact thought too.
Yeah, I mean, there were scenes there where I expected considerably more motion blur, and the phonetic nature of both the camera movement and the character I would have thought was mathematically dictating it. And I think it was just a sort of decision. You've got no idea what's going on. It's just a big blur. And I got to tell you, actually, on the IMAX, it is not worth seeing this film on IMAX if you're in the first half of the theater, because it does not...
any film in the IMAX.
The IMAX just really, it's quite overwhelming. It's almost headache-inducing. It's really hard to be able to lock your eye onto anything in some of those fight sequences. I mean, some of the stuff looks terrific, of course.
But I was the back of a normal cinema, and that's exactly the same as well. It is overall, as a, and this is not anything to do with effects people, it's overall, it is a little bit too close, and when it is rapid-fire cutting like that, it's a little bit too hard. So I was probably only about 5 or 6 rows from the back of a regular cinema, and I still found it a little bit too close. So yeah, anything other than like the last 5 rows of an IMAX theater is going to be
the same. There were some nice wide shots of the is it the Devastator, the one that the giant one in the quarry, that you had high and wide shots, and that really was terrific. So I've got to say that I just think the animation of Bumblebee was really good. I mean, it seemed to me that given the somewhat limited nature of what you could do with the facial stuff of a robot, they got tremendous posing, tremendous character, and really like an endearing character. I actually cared about what happened to Bumblebee much more than I cared even about what happened to Optimus Prime or any of the others. Had it been Bumblebee that had been... obviously it wouldn't work for the plot, but... I cared what happened to that robot in a way I didn't care what happened to most of the others at the same level. So I just thought they did an outstanding job in kind of communicating stuff with him. He had both qualities of a loyal dog and a kind of kick-ass warrior, which I thought was a really nice combination.
I mean, for me, every time Optimus Prime, you've got him in those close-ups, like he's there in the army sort of makeshift base there. You get these massive close-ups of him, and there's just so much detail in there. It's just I was riveted every time he was on the screen. It was quite fantastic.
I understand they deliberately made a choice to try and make the action harder and faster, and more sort of serious and the people and more at risk, and at the same time make the comedy broader and louder, which I think is why Skids and Mudflap, the twins, got a Guernsey. And obviously that's been heavily criticized.
And the little annoying humping bot.
Humpbot, which apparently was a bit of an homage to Wall-E, though I think that's a bit of a stretch.
I'm sure Pixar is very proud.
Yeah. But I think there is, there is like a lot of complex animation going on there to give and infuse those characters. But as you said, David, that fight scene in the forest was a real standout for an action sequence.
Yeah, that one reminded me of the King Kong T-Rex fight in Peter Jackson's King Kong. It was, which I think is the standout sequence in that entire movie as well.
I think what they improved on that was with all and a lot of the other scenes in here is that you really get this sense of physics. There is a real sense of weight and scale and size of a lot of this stuff. For me, it's a real bugbear for me that a lot of the time, as soon as something starts to need to move really fast, they all of a sudden start to break the sort of laws of physics about how fast something that's 60 foot high could actually move. So I think with that's the fight in the forest and a ton of other scenes, there's physics was really grounded on this stuff, and it just helps it just give everything such impact, I think.
Now, if I was going to name my favorite visual effects shot from both films, I have to say it's in the first film, and the shot that just I loved that I didn't quite ever match again in this film was the shot where he was virtually, I'm going to say ice skating, but it wasn't, up the freeway, smashes the bus in half. It was the trailer shot from the first film. And that was that, and there's a sort of a aerial slow motion flip over with a rocket going through in Transformers 1, both of which I thought was immensely powerful. But I noted to myself that both of those were slow motion shots. Do you think there were less slow-mo kind of action-y shots like that in this film? And there were a couple, but didn't seem to use that device as much.
I think I mean, what's always amazing about the Transformers is seeing them transform. And I think for a lot of the transformations in this, it is quite broken across multiple shots. And I think that for me, took away the beauty of it. A lot of the times where it's just like, oh my God, draw job, amazing. With that first time that you see
Optimus, that's the shot I was going to bring
up. Optimus built himself when he's driving into the Air Force or Army's hangar. And you just this, you know, it's all in one continuous shot. And you see the truck, and the truck sort of starts to form, and then you're sort of tilting up to his body to see his height. Yes, again, obviously form himself to five times higher than he could possibly have been. But, yeah, when it's all done in one shot, it's just all the more impressive and all the more amazing. Because, you know, as soon as you start to throw cuts in, it does feel like a little bit of a cheat. And part of the amazing thing about these things is that all of that mechanics fits into all of that truck or whatever. So to see it go from A to B cutless is, that's where I really, there was few and far between. So yeah, I can see where you sort of missed that from last time, but still, they still nailed it so beautifully in a few of those shots.
Yeah, the other shot I wonder, that was one of my favorites, which was one of the trailer shots for this one, was when Megatron's coming out of the water. With Megan Fox standing there, that was just one of, like, it was really well lit, really well composited, so grounded in the live action element. That was just an absolutely beautiful shot.
I must admit, my trailer shot was the aircraft carrier being destroyed.
Yeah, which looked okay in the trailer, but in the movie, it is quite amazing. I thought for me in the movie when it was, you know, obviously it's listing and all the F-14s are sliding off the deck, and then they've got this fantastic shot in the water where, you know, you're looking up to the surface and the debris and helicopters are all kind of sinking past you. And I just thought, I thought it looked okay in the trailer, but it was much, much, much better in the movie, that the whole aircraft carrier destruction.
Yeah.
Beautifully done. Beautifully
your favorite
done. Where
shot,
do you start?
David?
Where do you start with a shot like that? I mean, obviously, you've got a... I'm just constantly spending my whole time thinking, where do you even start with a lot of this stuff, which essentially is all CGI, probably the water, the you know, the aircraft carrier, the people on... Maybe you've got some little plates on green of guys jumping to their death off the water, but essentially every single element there in the shot, the sky, everything is all, you know, is all never existed.
I should point out, by the way, that that aircraft carrier that gets destroyed actually is an aircraft carrier seen later at the end of the film. There was a lot of jumping around between Roosevelt and... another one of my... It's my errors in geography thing, like I'm the only person that cares. Actually, the only one that did bug me
like
completely,
that, unfortunately.
And I don't know if it bugged you guys, but didn't... Am I missing something? But didn't they go to the... Where did they go with Wheelie to find... Wasn't that the Smithsonian? And if they went to the Smithsonian, then did
the air space again.
Where they go into the backyard and it's suddenly in the wilds of Utah.
How did that happen? Like, that was like so incongruous. And the other one, did you guys notice
let's face it, most of the people who go and see Michael Bay films don't spend a lot of time in museums, so they're never going to really...
But that was like, we're in an urban setting where suddenly...
This is traveling abroad to Egypt or going to the air and space.
But hang on, the other one was, he's on the phone and he says, a really weird thing happened to me in the lecture, I freaked out. She says, I'll be right there. He goes back to his dorm room, the girl comes over and she pulls up having got off the plane and walks in. I mean, did I not just miss like 7 hours of film time? I mean, wasn't the point that they weren't in the same city, that she had to fly there?
Like, you could take 7 hours just to get a cab to the airport.
I couldn't get to LAX, get a flight, land, get a taxi, and get somewhere in anything less than like 5 hours, but not the amount of time it would take me to walk from the dorm room back to the dorm and get attacked by a killer robot with a long tongue. Anyway, I was like, huh? The fact that Megan Fox can't even ride a motorcycle, I guess, was probably a really interesting visual effect. They had to keep pushing it and get
it going.
Yeah, there's
a nice cut between, bike pulls up and then cut to Megan taking helmet off inside the building. Anyway, you can't think like that.
Mike. Sure. So, David, what shot really did it for you? Did this something that you found really impressive?
Well, like I said, I really liked the Megatron coming out of the water, and I also liked everything involving the little panther robot.
That was nice, wasn't it?
Really, really well animated, and I just
Ravage.
Ravages, yeah. I also really liked the shot of where he barfed up all those little ball bearings.
That was amazing. That was amazing. I've got that on my list. That was fantastic. And then it turns into Shard Bot or whatever he is.
Yeah, well, they turn into the droidicals from Star Wars. And then they all form together to form into that little thin robot, the imitating every actress in Los Angeles, where if they turn the right way, you can't really see them because you're looking at them edge on.
I just thought that was brilliantly done. It was a beautiful transformation, and just I totally agree.
I really like that one.
But as a sequence, it was great. You know, he creeps up and rips off the ventilation shafts, kind of buffs the ball bearings down. They all scatter on the floor. You're in macro as they kind of start to meld together. And then they build this amazing robot. And you really see how he's sort of, you know, thinking and how he's kind of stealthily navigating through the... Ah, I just thought it was
very well done. In the homage department, the whole Darth Vader fallen scene in what I think was Saturn or Mars or something, which had to be the inside hole of leftover from Aliens or Alien. I didn't really neither need that nor really kind of fully get that.
It's on the meteor from
Armageddon.
That's
totally what I picked that as. I was like, he's now laying homage to himself, which is
I'm sure
quite
he does
amazing.
Daily. I'm sure he does daily. He's got a little shrine, I'm sure.
So, was there anything that we discussed in motion blur? I mean, I feel really horrible trying to pick at something this good in terms of its visual effects, but were there any areas that you thought maybe, just in the volume of work that was done, wasn't as strong?
There was one thing which I really thought looked cheesy, which was, I guess it was Soundwave, the tapping into the satellite. Yep. I thought that the like wires and fiber optic things and stuff that grew, I think to the general public they looked great. To me, they looked like very procedural type, L systemy type thing. And I guess do it cheap and do it fast. But I was a little bit surprised by the lack of complexity of the geometry on that.
As someone who doesn't know what the heck you just said, I thought that was fine. Didn't look cheap to me. I just thought it was. I thought it looked okay. It reminded me a little bit of Lego fiber optics in a lot of Lego kits. It just kind of looked very, very simple. But I certainly didn't pick up on the fact that it looked like it was a cop-out in any way, but that maybe you have to...
The only thing that really stood out for me, and I don't know if it did for you guys, but in both films it seemed wrong, is when they sucked up the attacking vehicles on the pyramid and then dropped them, there's a shot of a tank going down the side of the pyramid, and it's like a kind of a yellowy tank. And both times I watched it, I was like, that's cool, just got... Somebody's not turned on the correct level of shaders. It's like there was no ambient occlusion or something. It was just like this tank on the side of it was in a wide shot and it wasn't a particularly big tank. But I looked at both times, I was like, what happened to there? But again, in a sequence of like thousands of shots, like having one tank that doesn't look right is a pretty...
I must say, I didn't spot that particular bit, but I mean, anything involving, the ripping, when he starts tearing the blocks at the top of the... all the destruction and the... of the ripping apart of the pyramids, I thought was fantastic. When one of the robots starts climbing up the side of the pyramids, and there's all blocks falling down as he's kind of sort of tearing it apart as he's trying to get to the top. I thought all of that, again, that all really looked really big, and all the blocks sort of looked like they would be a ton of rock each. It just all...
I was paying attention to the blocks falling in that one, but now that you bring it up, Mike, there was one other shot which did bug me. There's a shot where the Decepticons are saying like, okay, now we're going to show the world that we're here, and they climb up to the top of, I think it's the Brooklyn Bridge, and knock the American flag over. And none of the traffic seemed to notice or care that there are these 260-foot robots. Like, you would think somebody would stop and go, hey, look, whoa, giant robot.
But by the same token, when they cut into the TV monitors, I kept on thinking, if I saw something like that cut in, it's a promo. I wouldn't pay any attention to it. Like, if you suddenly cut a robot on a TV screen, I'm not going to stop what I'm doing and stare at it because I believe it to actually be an alien from outer space that's talking to me. I'd be like, this is something... do you know what I mean? Like they didn't notice, for example, the guy, there was an Egyptian walking with a camel at one stage when all these rockets were, transformers were flying down as meteors, and he didn't bat an eyelid. Traffic didn't stop. But put something up on a monitor and everybody stops and looks at it. I'm like, really? I think, though,
and the other thing, and this is a plot point that bothered me, and it's a really minor thing, but they did explicitly mention, you know, that the president was President Obama, which, you know, I realize it's supposed to be sci-fi in the future, and therefore you have to have a black or woman president, but we actually have a black president now, so it's not quite so amazing. But when you actually name the president, and then you have characters talking about how the president's doing kind of dickish things to the Autobots and that kind of stuff, that, yeah. I like, it literally during the movie, it kind of took me out going, no, he wouldn't do that. You know,
I think they were trying to walk that line because, you know what, you have to normally have the government as the stupid guys and the military as the guys, you know, in this particular scenario.
No, that you do have the government as the big heavy, but this is why Morgan Freeman is still working.
I totally agree. I had the same thing. And then I looked at it the second time, and if you watch the dialogue, which I don't think counts, but if you watch it really or listen to it really carefully, they try and delineate that the guy appointed by the president is the dick. And even that final, you know, sorry, that early speech where he's saying, you know, if you tell us to leave, then, you know, if your president decides to make us leave, then ask yourself this, what would you do if you're wrong? But he means like the guy that's talking to him is wrong, not the president. In other words, Optimus Prime is kind of identifying that there's a difference between the minister guy who's the senator or whatever who's running things and the president he reports to. And I think they tried to walk that line. I don't think it works. I did exactly what you did. I was like, hang on a second. Obama wouldn't be like this. He'd be, you know. So I agree totally. But then,
this is definitely not a film to overanalyze.
Okay. You just... but having said that, I can't honestly say that on the actual shots of the Transformers that there was anything but the most impeccable shaders. I think the quality of the metal work just always looked to me like metal, didn't look like plastic. There was a ton of lighting effects, a ton of insanely hard tracking. So, yeah.
No, the effects are spectacular. The robots looked awesome. You know, it makes me excited to see Iron Man 2.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic visual effects, you know, feast. You know, but it's
just the rest backed up with a film around it.
The rest of the movie is breadsticks.
So frustrating.
You know?
How frustrating would you be, David? How frustrating would you be to do 3 years working on this or 2 years working on this film, and then it not be just great? You know, I mean, it doesn't matter. I guess it doesn't matter. Great
I would be really proud if I'd been on any of the visual effects companies on this. Could be hold their heart high.
Oh, with your own work, absolutely. But how?
Well, no. To get back to the show last week where you guys were talking about Contact and how there's so many shots that you didn't even realize were visual effects because you know you were so involved in the story. No one's paying attention to the story. They're only paying attention to the visual effects. So if you're a visual effects artist, this is the movie to be on because everyone's paying attention to your work, not what they're doing, not what the actors are saying.
I guess.
You know, the only thing you have to worry about is if your visual effect is in a scene with Megan Fox, because then, you know, half the audience is going to be staring at her and not your visual effect. But, yeah.
Okay.
You know.
I'm just interested from someone who obviously does that, whether you get to the end of it, and as long as you kicked your own goals, that's great. It doesn't end up being this sort of empty victory that the film
Look,
itself
nobody
isn't.
Wanted to work on that thing that... what was that film? The Scientologist,
Battleship Earth.
Yeah, okay, because no one sees that film, right? So I can't even remember the name of it. So you don't want to work on that film. But do you feel bad that you worked for several years producing the most amazing visual effects on a film that is going to be seen by more people this year than almost any other? Well, hell no.
No.
Do you know what I mean? Like, your problem is the one we started the conversation with, right? Is do I feel bad about doing insanely cool visual effects work on a film that isn't critically acclaimed? Well, you know,
problem is I didn't get paid $80 million to direct this film. I wish I did.
Yeah, but honestly, if you work on something, isn't it nice that it finds an audience? I mean, at the end of the day, finding an audience is a pretty big thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, yeah, look, and I can't I'm beating it up. I can't fault Michael Bay for making $80 million on this movie, because, you know, I know a lot of people get really annoyed when I say this, but we are in show business. Yeah. Our job is to make a product that people want to consume and pay money to do so. And, you know, so Michael Bay, you know, took somebody else's money, made a orgy of violence and robots smashing each other, and people gladly pay down their $15-$18 whatever they have to pay now to see a movie wherever they live, and you know, the movie made like $350 million worldwide in 5 days. I don't think I will ever make a movie that's going all the movies I make in my entire career. Not movies I work on, but movies I make myself, will never make that much money, you know, ever combined.
Hey, yeah. it was an ass whooping. It's supposed to hurt.
Yeah.
So on.
Look, overall, it's fantastic. It's that everyone's done. They've done a brilliant job. It's looks fantastic. Everyone should should definitely go see it on the big screen.
I think what would be really interesting is a really nice quality DVD, like a Blu-ray, that goes into the work that's been done on. I mean, I'm really looking forward to Sid Graff, because I hope like crazy that ILM or DD or both will do a breakdown, because, you know, we're discussing this film from what you can obviously see. I bet you there's a gazillion things we didn't even weren't aware of. But I'd love to know how much the environments were digital and how much the environments were, you know, just CG. I mean, that forest scene, like how many trees actually were fallen to get those sequences, where they, I mean, I just, you know, and the fact that I can sit here and honestly say, as a professional, I couldn't tell. I mean, it's a pretty impressive.
Absolutely. There's a lot of stuff where, you know, the camera's flying through the middle of trees, and I'm thinking, well, is this a Flying Fox rig, or are those trees replaced? I couldn't tell. It all looked, as you say, you don't really know. Is an entirely 3D forest to be able to move around, and, you know, was the camera ever even in a forest?
And I think the other thing people forget, I mean, obviously people listening to this podcast know this, but, you know, there isn't something that ILM or DD or somebody has that makes this easy to do. It's not like, you know, you know this very well, David, you can produce an amazing sequence like this, but if you've got one shot that's very complicated, it takes a long time to set it up, takes a long time to film it, and it takes a long time in post to do it. It's just you have a lot of people that are very talented working on this. This isn't like they have some special software that does this easy.
Yeah, I mean, the reason ILM and Weta and Digital Domain, you know, DNEG and MPC and all them, you know, continually are, you know, those are the houses you go to when you need something huge and new and spectacular. And the reason why is not because they have some magic computer in the back that, you know, you go and whisper sweet nothings in its ear and it gives you beautiful images out the other side. It's because they're staffed with incredibly talented, incredibly smart, incredibly creative people who create this. And you know, like, would I be proud to have my name on this movie? Yes. As anything other than the screenwriter? Yes. But, and maybe the editor. But the visual effects people who worked on this movie should be very, very proud. I've worked on movies which were, you know, a lot of fun to work on and weren't very good. I've worked on movies that were very good and not much fun to work on, and movies that were incredible amounts of fun to work on and are incredibly good. But you can't emotionally invest yourself and validate yourself by how the final product turns out in terms of the movie as a whole. Like, you can be proud of that, but you can, you know, you just need to say, am I satisfied with what I contributed to the film? And did I give the director what he wanted and what he asked of me to satisfy his vision? If his vision is the same as if you gave a mentally imbalanced monkey a jar of paints, that's fine. You know, that's what he wanted, and I gave him what he wanted, and that's what we're here to do.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it that they delivered what he wanted. I mean, this is what he wanted. He wanted this film to be what we've discussed, and you know, I just want to give a shout out to some of the companies that worked on it, because we've mentioned ILM obviously and DD, but Asylum also worked on this. Asylum, based in Los Angeles, they did really good work. I really loved the work they guys did back in the day on Master and Commander, but also Kerner Optical was doing a lot of miniature effects work, and I think the previous was done by Proof, and also Imaginary Forces did the opening title sequence. And while we're on credits, do you want to do our credit run David?
Sure. First off, you know, thank our researchers, Lori Apthorpe and Todd Schulten, for putting together all of our research and all of our show notes. They're absolutely invaluable to us, so thank you guys. And, of course, our producer and editor, Kristen Martin, who takes these... if you guys only knew the what goes on behind the scenes, you'd be much more thankful for all the hard work she puts in there. So thank you all. And this is a joint FX Guide Pixel Core production.
And I want to thank you guys for being a part of it. And Jace, thank you for joining us. Fate rarely calls upon us at a moment of our choosing, and you've come through for us today. Where can people find you on the tubes?
I think you've watched it too many times already, Mike. You can get me on my website, jasonwingrove.com, or on Twitter, twitter.com/Wingrove. Or as also on the other podcast, that Mike and I do together, Red Center, where we talk about digital cinematography, filmmaking, whatever, rat holes, you name it.
David?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DavidStrapenis or facebook.com/DavidStrapenis.
Are you posting again yet? Because you were not posting there for a while. You went into hiatus.
Yeah, I took a little time off for two reasons. I wanted to stay off the Twitter when I...
Off the grid?
Off the grid when I was taking my first initial break, and a little movie I've been working on had its first showing publicly over in Europe at the same time, so I was just like, I didn't want to deal with any of that kind of stuff, and so
David is referring here to a preview of Avatar that was shown in, we're not giving it away because it was in public knowledge, at in France, wasn't it?
Amsterdam,
I'm sorry. And got very good. In fact, I think that's also where Titanic got a reel or so shown back in the day. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you guys for listening. It's always a pleasure. I'm going off to Japan tonight, actually. I'm going up to Japan. I'm going up with Stu Mashowitz and John Montgomery. We're doing a whole bunch of stuff for the new term at fxphd.com, which you can check out at fxphd.com, including our digital SLR cinematography course, which we're going to be filming up in Japan, which should be good because, as you guys know, I think Stu's great, and getting the three of us together in Japan should be just a riot.
Awesome. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, it should be really, really cool. So, as always, thank you so much for listening. What you've just heard is, of course, top secret, so please do not tell my mother. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you.